Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there. Hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed a light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of just defending positions. As more of us have come to realize, fear and the fight-or-flight response puts us in our hindbrain, where we are hardwired for survival. Well, this is essential for short-term, but what about the bigger picture? Transformative ideas and evolutionary solutions, outside-the-box creativity, come from our forebrain. In times of crisis and upheaval, the urgency of the situation, or in our case, situation, gets our attention, and it's the creative part of ourselves that must give us the intention if things are to change. Our guest this week, Sharif Abdullah, has cultivated the ability to hold two ideas simultaneously, the ideal and the real deal, and use the dynamic tension between the two to help us get from the urgent crisis to the emergent opportunity. He uses the same analogy Bruce Lipton and I do in Spontaneous Evolution, the metamorphosis from caterpillar to butterfly, as a way of characterizing our current predicament. Even more intriguing, maybe trying to get from here to there keeps us crawling like a caterpillar along the same linear pathways that got us where we are. Instead, says Sharif, maybe we need to work backward from the butterfly so that we figure out how to get from there to here. Sharif Abdullah, J.D., is a consultant, speaker, author, and advocate for societal transformation. His mission is to bring currently dysfunctional systems and structures into alignment with our common human and spiritual values to create a world that works for all living things. Sharif consults with people and organizations on the leading edge of change, including government agencies, businesses, and social service organizations. As director of Commonway Institute, he has visited over 43 countries and over 100 distinct cultures, giving him a unique perspective on our global human and spiritual issues, and a vision that spans culture and class. He has proven experience in working with all peoples and in many different situations, bringing harmony in conditions of actual or potential conflict and discord. His books on leadership and societal change include the award-winning Creating a World That Works for All and Seven Seeds for a New Society. He'll also be talking about his latest work, The Chronicles of Upheavals, a fictional book that does indeed track us back from there to here. So, Sharif, before we start, I have to make a confession, and it relates to the way my mind operates and also the way the kinds of neighborhoods that you and I grew up in different towns, me in Brooklyn, you in Camden, New Jersey. When I was reading your bio, I read J.D. after your name, and given that where we both grew up, you probably remember that J.D. used to stand for juvenile delinquent, right?
That so, too, yes.
Exactly. How did you go from J.D., a degree of lawlessness, to J.D., a degree of law?
That is really interesting. Yes. I think a number of the adults in Camden would have considered me incorrigible. It was an interesting sojourn. You know, the divine knows exactly where each one of us is placed and for what reason. And one of the reasons of growing up on the bottom of society, Camden, New Jersey, being America's worst city, we're number one, gives me a perspective that is valuable in these times. It is very, very hard to lie to me. It's very hard to lie and say everything is doing fine because I know from the very beginning it wasn't. It's really hard to lie to me about our society is number one when I could live in the bottom of it. I could experience the bottom of it. And so I have a perspective that allows me to envision what a world that actually would work looks like. Early on for me, creating a world that works for all meant creating a world that works for all Black people, because mm-hmm. all white people were fine. We had a television. We could see all white people were having a ball. And it took me into going to college. I went to Clark University in Massachusetts, and experiencing the lives of people who were and were going to become the wealthy, the powerful, the controlling, to see that they were not well, okay? That just having money doesn't guarantee anything other than the fact that you've got money. That people who are at the theoretical top of our society are just as plagued with doubt, with suicide, with dysfunctional families, with the whole nine yards. So then I recognize that it doesn't work for any peoples. Then after college, I developed, what nowadays we would call an ecological perspective, and recognize that we treat the earth like our playground and our toilet, and that the earth herself as a living being, we don't treat her as a living being. We basically treat her like our cesspool. And so this notion of creating a world that works for all literally means creating a world that works for all living beings. The opposite of that is what we're living in right now, which is creating a world that works for money. And there are a few people still left that think that's a good idea, and I'm not talking to them right now. For the majority of us, even for the people that we want to label and separate from that we call the 1%, even for the 1%, the world isn't working. The problem is we don't have the model, we don't have the vision, and we don't have the mechanisms to get everybody in gear to make that happen. Now, all the gears are sitting in front of us, just like having a disassembled car. And what we need to do, instead of looking at the disassembled car and saying, gee, I hope somebody gets around to assembling that one of these days, we need to be the ones that have the blueprint. And the blueprint is having a vision, and that vision is creating a world that works for all. Now, I'm not saying that formulation to try to tout my book, although you should buy the book. I'm saying that there are a number of different thinkers and a number of different feelers, I should say, who have seen the necessity of a global transformation. And I'm thinking about William McDonough, who wrote the book Cradle to Cradle. Right. And he said his vision is we can create a world where we love all the children of all species for all time. Now, that's just as cool as mine, okay? Now, or my friend Mark Anielski, who wrote a book called The Economics of Happiness, and his formulation is we can create an economy that is based not on money, but based on enduring love. And what would an economy like that look like? I would really like to find out.
Yes, that would be a worthy experiment. And, you know, we have a lot of examples of dystopian, you know, if you think about the movies of the past 50 years or so, many dystopian visions out there. So we've got a lot of pictures floating around in our heads of what it's going to look like when things really don't work. And it's very difficult for people to make that transition from I don't want this, I don't want this, I don't want this, and keeping that conversation going to address the question, and what would you like instead? Not as a insulting challenge, but really as an inquiry. Okay, we understand that. So what would it look like if it worked? That seems to be the dynamic tension that we have right now.
Exactly. Yeah, one of the things that I've been doing, especially in the post-COVID environment, is steering my webinars and steering my workshops away from we don't want this system or we don't want these people into tell me what you do want. And it's really, really hard for people to do that. I think that many people in this society, on the left, the right, and undefined, it's hard for us to think anymore. I used to teach at the university level, at a few different universities, including Portland State University right here in town. And what I found over time is that students were getting more and more A's, but were able to think less and less. They considered substituting rational thought for reflective journaling, and we're seeing lots of reflective journaling in things like Facebook, etc. But it means that we lose the capacity to actually encounter and challenge and hone each other's ideas. We think anybody who says something that's different from what I'm saying is attacking me. And they're not. It's like, let's figure out what it is that we're trying to say together. And that loss of capacity means a real challenge for the creation of a new society. Because no one, and that's including me and you and everybody else, no one is going to have all those answers and put them all together and say, here's the book that's got all the answers. Just subscribe here, and then you're done. Just follow this. What we have to do, and I mean all of we, what we have to do is start looking at how do all of us come together and how do all of us bridge the gaps. We don't recognize that it's always in someone's best interest for the gap to be there. Somebody is making money from the conflict itself. By transcending the conflict, and what I mean conflicts, I mean the conflicts between races and ethnic groups, the conflicts around gender, the conflicts around class, that all of these things are pushing us in a direction. And that direction is for us to look at things in a wholly different model. And that model is going to be something that is new to all of us. And you were talking about the caterpillar and the butterfly. And I think we need to get into that a little more, a little further down the road. But yeah, all of us need to do it, and all of us need to bring it together.
You know, one of the things that's been really irking to me is that the left has become the censors, the political correct. Mm-hmm. You can't say this, you can't say that. We can't have that right-wing guy speak on our campus. We won't even let him speak.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. People deplatformed and dismissed if they somebody says, well, I think there's only two sexes. Nope, you're going to get ghosted and you're going to be deplatformed. How is it that the left has become so totalitarian, and how can we open up some space for real conversation and listening?
This is exactly what I was just saying about people not being able to tolerate the fact that we have differences of not even of opinion. We have differences of viewpoint and perspective. And there's been so much around, if you are not singing out of this hymnal, you're wrong. So instead of this being a political discourse, this becomes an article of faith. I don't know how many meetings I've been in where people start off by saying, well, we all know what we believe. And I was raised my hand. No, I don't know what people in this room believe. I know what you make assumptions around. I had a friend who worked for Planned Parenthood. And she had questions around the issue of abortion. Not that she was against it. It's just that, should it be used in this circumstance and should it be used in that circumstance? And they ostracized her to the point that she had to leave just because she had questions. Now, that's right. Not a world that's working for all. It's not even working for your supporters. And we have to be able to embrace all of those issues and all of those challenges.
Great. Well, we're going to be back after this short break and talk more about the caterpillar to butterfly, our current COVID situation, and how we can begin to allow ourselves to listen more and learn more. This is Steve Behrman. We're on WikiPolitik.
With the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
A social distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others, and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back on WikiPolitiki with Sharif Abdullah. And Sharif, you know, we just had a little commercial there that pointed to social distancing. So why don't we just jump into possibly some alternative ways of addressing the current COVID-19 crisis/opportunity and some insights that you might want to share about that.
Yeah, I was there are times when I have experiences in the world that I don't want. I mean, I actively, sincerely don't want this experience. And in the middle of it, I wonder, why am I having this experience? And then 5 years later or 10 years later, or in this case, 15 years later, it makes sense. So during the SARS pandemic that was threatening our planet some years ago, I was I've done a lot of work in Sri Lanka, as you know, and I was coming back from Sri Lanka and doing my very best to avoid going to Hong Kong, which was the epicenter of the SARS infection. And so I wound up routing myself through Bangkok and Singapore, go all the way around Hong Kong. And while my plane to Bangkok was in the air, the pilot comes on and says, "We've just been diverted to Hong Kong." So here I go to Hong Kong, the epicenter of SARS, at the height of the infection rate. And no masks, no preparation, nothing going on. And I got to see how a country actually handles infection when a virulent disease like COVID or SARS or anything like that, when they're serious about it. When we stepped off the airplane, we were met by masked and covered health workers who had these digital thermometers. And as we stepped off the plane using laser technology, they took all of our temperatures. And they took our temperature so fast, when you're walking off the plane, there's a person walking in front of you, so you're walking, reasonably fast but reasonably slow. And if they had a temperature, they pulled them over for secondary screening. If they had SARS, they put them back on the plane. While I was in the Hong Kong airport for hours, my temperature got taken maybe 20 or 30 times. Everybody's aiming these digital guns at you, thermometers at you, and taking your temperature. Now, in those countries that did that, in the countries that do that, COVID is simply not a factor in the country. COVID has no is no longer in China. The numbers of dead in places like Singapore, Hong Kong, Tokyo, etc., are just in the double digits total. The total dead in Singapore is 21. As of the last time I checked, which was yesterday. Compare that to New York City. New York City would love it if they had only 20 people dying a day. We have taken, so here are all these Asian countries that know what they're doing. Then you take the United States, which hasn't a clue of what to do. And the United States says, okay, we're going to try this untried technology before of social distancing. And the result has been you've got hundreds of people dying every day in New York City, and you won't go out and buy the digital thermometers and do it right. So it's... There are a number of reasons why this is the case. All of them point to our arrogance. All of them point to our believing that we know better than the rest of the world. All of them point to our innate racism, that how could those people over there know something better than what we know over here. So our challenge is, number one, we need to humble ourselves. Number two, we just need to look at the numbers and say, it looks like these folks the folks over there know something that we don't know. If you take the people who have died of COVID in Tokyo and in Hong Kong and in Singapore and in the entire country of New Zealand, if you take all of the people who have died of COVID, it doesn't come to a single day in New York City. The problem isn't COVID. The problem is how we're handling it. The problem is generating fear instead of generating positive, effective action. And Steve, you were talking about the commercial that just aired about standing apart from each other, et cetera. That was a really, that was the first positive commercial I've heard about this. It's not just avoid contact. It's like, this is how to stay connected. You know, even with a mask on, you can smile at someone. And I've seen the people who can smile through their mask. Okay. Or you can, give blessings to someone. Or, as I said, you can wave or you can do lots of other things to stay in contact. The people here in Portland seem to believe that, number one, COVID spreads through eye contact. So the people on the streets are not making eye contact. They seem to think that there's a similarity between 6 feet and 30 feet. I've seen people, I'm on a wide sidewalk, 10 feet, 12 feet wide. We're about to pass each other, and this person will step out into the middle of the street after being 10 feet away, okay? And that they believe that satisfying fear is the same thing as being safe, and it's not. Succumbing to your fears just makes your entire metabolism, including your spirit, weaker. It means that you are more open to more fear. So every day, and I'm going to pick this isn't video, but I've got my prop in my hand here. Every day before I walk out the door, I carry my official N95 mask with me. I carry it. I don't put it on. I tell myself I will put this on when my intuition says that I need to be wearing a mask. I trust my intuition. Every day I confirm that I trust my intuition, and every day I confirm that the COVID infection is nowhere near me. It's nowhere near. It's in the nursing homes in Portland, which I think is a tragedy for the people who are experiencing it. It's in certain group living arrangements, like in a veterans home, et cetera. But we shut down Eastern Oregon because there's some nursing homes in Portland that are experiencing COVID. We are doing this out of fear, not out of the knowledge that of how this thing spreads, and not out of the knowledge of how the people in places like Singapore and Hong Kong got on top of their infection rate and got on top of the stopped the spread. Let me say one last thing about that, Steve. In those countries, they set out a goal, and the goal was to attack the virus, not the people. So they didn't lead with lockdown, and they tested everybody with digital thermometers until they could come up with a competent test. We did almost the opposite, okay, and thought that the opposite would work. We wanted to manage the problem, not stop it. Remember when everybody was talking about flatten the curve? There was an assumption. Oh, yeah, we're going to get sick, but we don't want to overwhelm the hospital. In Singapore, they said, no, we're not going to get sick. We're going to stop the folks from even catching this thing in the first place. And if you want to stop people from catching it, what you do is what they did. Okay. And what you do. So if you look at New York City on the one hand, and you look at Singapore on the other hand, I'm looking at the numbers from yesterday now, right now, from the Worldometer's information, and they seem to have the most reliable worldwide information. The Singapore death rate has held steady in the low 20s for weeks now. Their deaths per million population for Singapore is 4 people. Now, the same rate for yesterday was 500 new deaths in the United States. The deaths per million population is 302. Okay, so you have 4 people on one hand, 302 people on the other hand. The virus is exactly the same in both places. It's how we dealt with it is the problem. And I am not talking about how we dealt with it with Democrats or how we dealt with it with Republicans. It's the same everywhere. We missed the step. And our populations are paying the price for that.
Well, you know, it's definitely true that in this country, you mentioned managing the problem. And we have an entire so-called healthcare system that's not that healthy and not that caring, that focuses on managing the problem, just mainly that, you know. And so naturally, or we would say unnaturally, that's the kind of quote-unquote solution that the system would come up with. And, you know, on one hand, you have, crazy Donald Trump. And on the other hand, you have the Center for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, actively censoring anything that is not the exact Pravda party line. In fact, there was just a communique from Facebook today by the CEO of Facebook that essentially said, we will delete anything that contradicts the World Health Organization on COVID-19. This is from YouTube. I'm sorry. The CEO of YouTube said that. Anything that would go against World Health Organization recommendations would be a violation of our policy. So that includes vitamin C. Nothing wrong with vitamin C.
Right.
And those are things that that they've deplatformed.
And trusting your intuition.
That's true. You have to actually censor that too. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. We won't do that. And so here we have everything wrong with top-down control. And of course we have a system where people don't trust the political parties, either of them.
Yep.
And so this is the condition that we have here, almost predictable. And so it seems like it's only going to continue along the same lines.
Yeah. But the problem, though, is one of my spiritual teachers, when asked why do people act a particular way, she would just say, squirrels bury nuts. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do. What we do, if you are the kind of person who believes in command and control, then if you see a situation, what you want to do is exercise command and control. If you are a person that believes in the innate possibilities of our internal divinity and want to enhance that, then you'll act a different way. So how you're acting, whether it is in accordance with the essence of life for all of us, or it's in accordance with our I would say our lowest and our most fearful instinct. I would say in accordance with the caterpillar.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're going to continue to do that. So one of the things, and because you know this about the analogy, the metaphor of the caterpillar and the butterfly. After the caterpillar spins that chrysalis and dissolves completely, inside the chrysalis, the caterpillar cells will continue to attack the butterfly cells. They'll continue to do that until the butterfly cells clump together and get strong enough for them to be able to not resist that attack, but to become butterfly enough to absorb the caterpillar cells and turn those cells into butterfly. So the butterfly resolves the conflict by there not being any conflict. It's like all of us will join together here, and all of us will have a role to play in this completely different being that crawls out of the chrysalis. A 20-leg being crawls in, a 6-leg being comes out. A being that only can be on the land, has no flying capabilities whatsoever, spins the chrysalis. What comes out of it is a being that flies. One of my favorite cartoons is two caterpillars on a twig looking up at a butterfly. And one is saying to the other, "You'll never get me up in one of those things." the answer is, "Oh yes, you will."
But it requires a certain kind of transformation.
Right, a transformation that they don't ask for. One of the questions is, what goes through the mind of the caterpillar when it attaches its butt to the twig and begins the process of spinning the chrysalis? Well, the utopian unicorns and rainbows view is the caterpillar saying, "I'm attaching my butt to this twig so that I can become a beautiful butterfly." But the reality is that caterpillar is probably saying, "How did my butt get attached to that twig? And how do I get it off? Because I want to go eat some more." Okay.
Yeah.
And so our right now, all the discourse you're hearing from left, right, center, CDC or whatever, is how do we get this caterpillar's butt off the twig so it can get back to the business of devouring the earth?
We have to take a break now. We'll be back with the caterpillar butterfly and how to get there from here or hear from there.
Yeah.
Steve Behrman, we're talking with Sharif Abdullah on WikiPolitiki. Back soon.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please, help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, Steve Berman, we're back with Sharif Abdullah. Sorry, I interrupted you. I'm from New York. We interrupt people all the time, so I'm used to that.
Well, yeah.
but you were talking about the caterpillar and butterfly, and I wanted to ask, you know, this is a process of nature, and obviously the caterpillar doesn't have free will, but we do. And so is there a way to accelerate? Well, we don't know. I mean, we don't want to answer for more five caterpillars. They hate it when we do that, right? So, but really, is there a way to accelerate the process of we imaginal cells, or we who imagine we're imaginal cells, connecting and weaving together this new butterfly organism? Is it something that simply do we have actual free will in that aspect of the situation in bringing people together to accelerate this process?
Steve, I'm doing so many Zoom calls nowadays that I'm doing all of these gestures as though you can see me. As you were talking, I'm nodding like, oh yes, and I say, oh, wait a minute, the camera's not on. Okay.
We do have some psychics listening to the show, and they can see you.
Oh, there you go. There's that. And yes. Also, if it's not psychics, you can hear my neck bones cracking as I'm agreeing with you. Okay. First of all, the caterpillar, we talk about nature or instinct. We can also talk about that as the will of the divine. And by that, I am not talking about religion, and I'm also not even particularly talking about theocracy. I'm just saying that there's a will that's above that of the human on some other dimensional level, and all of us respond to that. I was thinking about that as I was attending the birth of my first daughter, first of three daughters, and I was thinking that everybody in this space is doing something. And everybody, including my wife, if they could stop doing it, would have stopped in their tracks and say, let's do this next week. You know, this is really intense. Let's just back up here. And so, all of us at some point in time are answering divine imperatives that we don't create and that we are responding to. I believe that entire societies do that, and that's what we are living in right now. If I can share something that happened to me a few years ago, I was in here in Portland, and I had the opportunity to meet the late Eldridge Cleaver. I actually met him 3 weeks before he died. And for those of you, for those who don't know who Eldridge Cleaver was, he was the author of the New York Times bestseller Soul on Ice and was one of the co-founders of the Black Panther Party. He just happened to be in Portland, and some people, my people and his people, brought us together. And I was talking to him about Commonway. I'm not even sure Commonway even had a name at the time. But I was talking to him about the idea of societal transformation. And he was listening pretty intently. And when I finished, he said, Sharif, you're trying to change the tire on a moving car. He said, the tire definitely needs to be changed, but the car won't stop. And I realized back in March that the car stopped. That for I don't even know given the fact that we have this proven technology of taking people's temperature at public choke points, where large groups of people come together on the subway, in airplanes, on crowded street corners, et cetera. And we have a proven technology, we throw that in the trash. We have this completely unproven technology, and we've watched our numbers, the numbers of deaths skyrocket, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, somebody stopped the car, okay? Now, the question is, what do we do with this time in order for us to fundamentally restructure society? But in order for us to fundamentally restructure society, we have to restructure ourselves. And I want to say that very clearly. I have to restructure myself. I've been using this time to restructure myself, to become a better butterfly self. Hmm. I have to restructure my community, the people I've been working with and connecting with. We have to restructure our local communities, our regions, restructure our continent. And you notice that I skipped over nations and restructure our planet. What Daniel Kemis, who's the former mayor of Missoula, Montana, and a friend of mine, said in his book, The Politics of Place, that we will owe our allegiance to at three different levels. One is the local level. So my allegiance will be to my city state here in Portland. And Portland meaning not just the political entity of Portland, but the surrounding small cities that make up the Portland area. This had the second place that you owe your allegiance is to your watershed. Where do you get your water from, and who takes water from you? Because those we are in an intimate relationship with all of those folks. And then the third is our continent. Drawing lines on a continent makes no sense whatsoever. And 100 years from now, we'll understand that. And so our challenge is, how do we embrace our allegiances? How do we learn how to see things differently? How do we learn to see that there is no difference? There's no fundamental difference between what is happening in the United States of America and the country of Mexico or the country of Canada. And then to recognize there's no difference in anywhere else in the world. That we all have the same basic needs. We all have the same basic values, and that, well, we should have. Right now, our primary value is valuing money, which I think is a nonsensical idea. But you know, so valuing life, that should be our operating thought. How do we enhance and value life? How do we value each other, all of the beings I'm in relationship with, from those outside of me, meaning the trees, the birds, the flowers, the other people, and then those inside me, my own gut biome, all of the beings my life is inextricably linked to their life. If they die, I die. And therefore, I should treat them really, really well, as opposed to the way most Americans treat them, which is not at all, and think that we can just take a pill and therefore continue to ignore them. So our challenge is, how do we interact with each other the way that our ancestors interacted with each other, of recognizing that our lives are linked to each other? Okay, let me tell you just one more story, then I'm gonna shut up for at least 10 seconds. So I was there was a African American woman who was buying some land in Ohio, I think. But it was right in an area where there were a lot of Amish people, and her neighbors were Amish. Mm-hmm. And so she had no problem with that. So she bought the land, and so within a week, her neighbors had come to her and had brought her gifts of like jams and jellies and some knitted materials, just a kind of like a welcome wagon thing. She said, thanks a lot. And a week later, they came back with some jams and fresh eggs and other things, and had another conversation. And then a week later, they came back and said, we're going to be putting up some preserves. We're going to be doing such and such. Would you like to join us? And the woman said, I realized at that time that they had a fundamental interest in not having a dependent neighbor, not having a neighbor that didn't know how to take care of themselves. Hmm. And she joined them not to become an Anabaptist and start wearing a bonnet and black clothes and trade in her Toyota for a horse, okay? But she joined them so that she could be an integral part of an interdependent community. Now, the way that we do community here is, I live in an apartment complex and I like all my neighbors. Okay, I mean, I really do. I'm sure there's some listening right now, but I really do like all my neighbors. But I don't need them for anything. If they got up and left, it wouldn't affect my life one bit. And that is not a healthy relationship. That's not a healthy way to act in the world. And we should be doing something to act differently.
Well, it's interesting that there's the term apartment as opposed to togetherment. An apartment.
Exactly.
Designed to keep people apart. It keeps them compartmentalized.
Exactly.
Again, we're living in this so-called civilization. Now, I grew up in a housing project, and so there were hundreds of people living in this area. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't help but know your neighbor. You were right on top of them. And we really did help one another. We really did in this teeming housing project. People knew one another, and they looked after one another. So it's not something that has to do with necessarily urban or rural. It has to do with a kind of mindset that we've learned to want to keep private and separate in our own little private vehicles, in our own little private bubbles. And so we've got about 3 minutes left. I want you to talk about your fiction book that you wrote, which is The Chronicles of the Upheavals. And perhaps the value of that work in helping us reverse engineer what might work in the future to what could work right now.
Right. So Chronicles of the Upheavals is set 100 years in the future, 2125. And in that future, humanity makes it. We make it through all of the free-floating crap that we're either experiencing now or about to experience. And the people who are the leaders in 2125 say, we should bring together a history of what did we do 100 years ago that got us to this point where we can say confidently, we live in a world where there is no poverty. We live in a world where there is no violence. We live in a world where there is no want. We live in a world where people are basically fulfilled with each other, and with life as a whole. So they commission this writing, The Chronicles of the Upheavals, that starts 100 years in their past in 2025. And to do this history, they just follow a handful of young people as they start their journey from being preteens to being 100 years later, the old wise and people who are in leadership positions. It's told in a really unique style because it makes the assumptions that in the chronicles, in the upheavals, we lose a lot of our human reference points to cyber wars, to real wars, to diseases, to lots of other things. Anything that could plague humanity hits us, and it hits us all at the same time with a multiplying effect. So our challenge is how do we manage these upheavals? How do we manage them with a new set of values, and our values being nonviolence? How do we manage this with, how do we manage things with values that say we are one?
Wow. Well, you know what? On our WikiPolitiki page for this show, when you download that page, you'll be able to get a link to Chronicles of the Upheavals, and you'll be able to get the, while supplies last, the free copy. So thank you so much, Sharif Abdullah, for joining us today and talking with us on WikiPolitiki about the perhaps the upheaval, which is a lot easier to deal with than downheaval, which is
exactly
which is what we should be having. It's a lesser of two evils. So anyway, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us today.